Okay, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of Planet Porky, okay? I am, of course, Mike Parry, the Porkmeister. And over the next half hour, I'm delighted to say I have an absolutely stunning and fabulous guest with me. It is, of course, Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
How are you doing?
I am doing absolutely fine, but I'm doing better because you're here, okay? Planet Porky is a dynamic new podcast, right? We're soaring very high into the stratosphere, all rockets firing, everything to go for. And I'm delighted that you are so far my star guest on this mission to educate the world and the followers of the Porkmeister, OK? Now, first of all, let me just tell everybody the sort of background to the relationship you and I have had over maybe 30, 35 years.
Steady.
All very innocent and we all know that. But you were the top rock chick reporter in the 80s, 90s, maybe even earlier than that. You got to know so many famous people. You've already written a Sunday Times bestseller involving Freddie Mercury, Bohemian Rhapsody and all that. But your latest book, Tumbling Dice, is a, you've called it a memoir. I'd call it an absolute voyage through Fleet Street at the height of the hedonism. What's the best story in here?
Well, because we know where all the bodies are buried.
Well, that's right.
There's been a lot of furore.
Well, Bill Wyman has been
a great story.
I asked you a question which I'm not going to answer. And have you had to make some apologies to people about your role in the Bill Wyman saga?
Yes and no. I mean, I was involved. He did use me as a foil for his relationship with a child. Mm. And he hasn't...
You're talking about Mandy Smith.
Mandy Smith.
Would you describe her as a child? Because you didn't know how old she was, did you?
Well, I'm describing her as a child now. Mm. Mandy was 13 when she started dating Bill. We had no idea she was that young.
Yeah.
Because she didn't look that young. She looked like Brigitte Bardot walking down King's Road. With all the cascading blonde hair and the shape and the clothes and the attitude. She was amazing.
Yeah.
And we just thought she was 18, 19, had no idea that she was still at school or that he was paying the school fees in a private school that he'd transferred her to from her state school up in North London.
Yeah.
And she hung out with us. We were a gang. We went out every night, ended up in Tramp. And, of course, the limo at the end of the night always had Bill and Mandy left in the back.
Right.
And we didn't think.
Where did they go?
Who knows?
No, I see.
344 King's Road, I should imagine.
344 King's Road.
That's where he was living at the time.
Oh, I see, yeah. I remember years ago reading her account in which... wherever Bill was playing, Paris or something like that, he'd fly her out there. And in fact, it was in Paris that, according to her, they consummated their relationship.
And she did later state that she was 14 at the time.
My God, I didn't know that.
We all went to her birthday party. Yeah. Bill had this party in a French restaurant called Thierry's on the King's Road.
Yeah.
And there we are with a massive great cake, one candle. So a friend of mine said, go on then, man. Tell us how old you are today. Oh, 15, she said. And we all went...
She just said it quite innocently.
Quite innocently.
She wasn't trying to hide anything.
And we scarpered. We were terrified.
Yeah.
We thought we'd done something wrong by backing up this relationship in some way. And so the group fell apart. The friendship group disintegrated. Mm. And no conversation was ever had about it. But I think we were scared.
Yeah. The reason I remember it so well is that I was editing the Daily Express on a Sunday and it was the splash in the news of the world. And the Daily Express didn't deal in stories like that at the time. But I remember thinking, this is too big a story to pick up. It actually said that Bill Wyman's girlfriend was 14. How do you think that story got into the news of the world? Because clearly you weren't the source of it because you've just said you were frightened to be associated with it.
I wasn't yet on Fleet Street, of course. I was on television myself at that time, having a sort of 15 minutes of fame. So I was a TV presenter. Bill had seen me on telly and had got his secretary, Karen, to call up the studio and get my number and ask me out. So I was being groomed myself.
You were being groomed as cover for Mandy?
As the sort of the fake girlfriend, yeah.
Right.
So whenever we got to anywhere in the limo, Bill would take my arm, we'd get out the car.
I see.
And then another one of the guys would take Mandy.
Yeah.
And inside the place, we behaved normally, as we'd want to. But
did you go to Annabelle's and places
like
that?
Annabelle's, Tramp.
Really?
Morton's, everywhere,
yeah.
And and it would be a sort of party central car.
Yeah.
Everyone would jump in the car and then it would go from place to place to place, get home about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Was George Best around in those days?
Very much so.
Really? Yeah. Did you see George as well?
Not generally vertical, but yeah, you'd see George out there.
Well, didn't George like to want to get to know you better? He normally did with attractive women.
I don't think he got near. I think Bill was always in the way.
Oh, I see.
You
know,
yeah.
Bill stuck to you that closely.
A little bit,
as the cover, so to speak.
Yeah. The foils.
That's absolutely amazing. So on this particular day, on this Sunday, I got crime reporters to start ringing up Scotland Yard and saying, surely this is an offence, isn't it? Why did nobody ever do anything about it?
It's a very simple question to answer. The police, the CPS, cannot investigate any case unless they have a formal complaint from some individual.
Yeah.
So not Mandy, not her sister Nicola, not her mother, the father had scarpered years ago.
Yes.
Nobody had gone to the police and said, this has happened and we would like it investigated.
Yeah.
Without a complaint, they can do nothing.
Yeah.
So Bill himself said a few years ago, well, I took myself off to the nearest cop shop and said,
and
do you want to interview me?
Yeah.
And they said, no case to answer. Yeah. So people tend to think he's innocent.
Yeah.
But he's not.
No. Why did he end up marrying Mandy Smith? Because presumably, and I've never spoken to Bill Wyman, but a man takes his pleasures from a young girl like that, but doesn't usually end up marrying her because there's another girl coming along. Once Mandy's got to a certain age, he might have gone and sought another young girl. I mean, why did he marry her?
Okay, there's a big suggestion of a payoff scenario.
That
this would cleanse Mandy's reputation in some way.
Yeah.
And also she never was allowed to speak to the press because of the terms of their deal, if you like. But the marriage lasted, a year and a half?
And she married a guy called Vanden Howe, did she?
She did
Vanden
marry
Howe.
Pat.
He was a nutter, because I'm an Everton fan, and he was known as, a crazy fullback who clattered into people and liked sort of trying to break their legs.
I think that was the downfall of Mandy, really, because she's been ill ever since. And that marriage was also very short-lived.
Yeah, it was.
And then
she
moved to Manchester and she had a son by a male model and she began counselling abuse victims. What does that tell you?
Yeah, because she'd been through it herself, I suppose.
She's never had a normal life, and I feel very guilty about it because I feel we should have all stuck up for Mandy and done something. We were young as well.
Yeah.
You know, we were early 20s ourselves.
Sure.
Yeah, okay, that's a grown-up. But we had no idea how to handle this.
Yeah.
And I feel really bad about it looking back because we could have saved her.
Okay, but if you'd have known then, I mean, would you have done something about it? So let me extend that question. You knocked around with some of the most famous people in the world of rock and roll. I used to see you in the, what was that, Daily Mail pub we used to use down the bottom of the stairs there.
Oh, the Harrow?
The Harrow, that's right, and all that kind of stuff. And you've just come from seeing some other great famous rock star and all that. Were you able to draw the line? This is a question you have to ask all Fleet Street journalists, including crime reporters and all that, between what you knew and what you wanted to put into print.
It was an interesting situation for me because I'd been a minor celebrity myself, and that's how I knew all these people.
How'd you been a minor celebrity?
On television. I was TV presenter.
Right, okay. Who was that with?
So Channel 4 launched
a rock
magazine show, Post Tube, called ESA.
Right.
And I co-presented it with Nicky Horn and Gary Crowley, the Capital Radio disc jockeys.
Right. And how did they find you then in the first place?
How did they find me? I was working at Chrysalis Records in the art department, doing the sleeve notes on the back of, singles bags and album sleeves.
Without making you blush, your looks your looks meant that people noticed you and you had personality and you suddenly found yourself...
I went for an audition. I was asked to go for an audition and I got the gig. And so suddenly...
Excellent.
Everything I did was on the front page of The Sun.
Right.
To the point that Kelvin McKenzie phoned me up, the editor of The Sun at the time, and offered me a column as a girl around town doing my thing, which I wrote three times a week. And then the Daily Mail poached me from The Sun.
I see, Well, we all know McKenzie.
Kelvin wasn't at all happy about
it. I know him far too well, unfortunately, but that's another story. And so you went to the Daily Mail as... a showbiz reporter, not a columnist.
And a music writer. But I already had all these friends who were celebrities because of people I'd interviewed on the TV show. So I was kind of one of them, obviously not in their league, but there was a reason for me to make friends with those people.
Yeah. Now, so when you got to the Mail, because of
that's
your contacts...
That's why they hired me, for my contacts work.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. But you must have then been under pressure to bring in a great story every day.
Sure. I wouldn't expose most of their personal lives because I would never have seen them again. They would never have had me round for dinner again or down to the south of France.
But does that mean that you were only then writing positive stories about these people instead of the negative stories, which is really what Fleet Street wanted, certainly what the Mail would have wanted? And would it have been... It wouldn't have been Paul Dacre in those days, would it?
No,
his
David English.
David English, yes, yeah. David English, yeah. Absolutely.
So how we worked it out was that I did interviews with these people. Mm. So, you know, go and interview Mick Fleetwood, Rod Stewart, whoever it is.
Yeah.
But the interview content would be slightly leaning in their favour and would always be promoting their latest record or tour, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And what happened on the road stayed on the road. We didn't write that stuff.
Yeah.
We got away with it. I think it was enough that I had access to the biggest stars because of what I had been doing before.
Yeah.
And they were my friends.
Yeah. No.
So that was really what they wanted. They weren't going to get dirt out of me because that would have killed my friendships.
But I agree. Some rock stars are happy to reveal things to you which other people might be aghast at, which they see as perfectly normal. You know what I mean? Tell me, for instance, because I remember... I was the news editor of The Express then, and a colleague of mine knew you very well. And because he knew you very well, and you knew everybody, I just used to tell him just to stick to you shoulder to shoulder, because everywhere you went, I wanted him to follow. And one of the people that involved was Boy George.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Well, I got the scoop and the splash and everything on that story, which was...
On which particular story?
Boy George's addiction to heroin.
Right.
So I'd spent the night in a boot of a car with George up on Hampstead Heath one night. God knows what we came up with that for.
What were you doing in the boot?
I think we thought this would be a good new interview venue, that we could... interview each other in the boot of a car. So
no, you couldn't have been. You don't mean like the boot you lift up and then close and you were inside.
Well, we didn't close it. We left it open.
But it
was a sort of car boot interview type scenario.
Well, you were both sitting in the back of the car. In the grounds of his home.
In the dark with a bottle of wine.
Right.
And this was our new interview setup. I think Boy George came up with it and I thought this was hilarious.
And how did it become apparent that Boy George was a heroin addict?
He revealed it himself. He made a statement saying he had 6 weeks to live. So, of course, everybody rushed up to Hampstead to bang on his door.
Yes.
And I was the only one he let in.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So I had the interview and that was splashed on the front page of the Daily Mail because everybody else was following it up.
Yes.
But I got in there first.
No, that's great. I was in America a few years before when Boy George and the Culture Club went on their first North American tour. And it was in Montreal. So I went up there because I was working with the Daily Express in New York in those days. And I suddenly stumbled across the story about him and the drummer being lovers.
Oh, John Moss. Yeah, they were.
Yeah, they seriously.
They came on our programme and told that story.
Right.
And I remember John Moss going into how he realised he was in love with George.
Yeah.
And then he sort of winked at him off camera and he went, all right, George, as if they'd set it up beforehand, they'd agreed what they were going to say.
But they fell out. This was the problem.
Well, of course they fell out. No, everybody falls out in a band, don't they?
Yeah, but the reason that it became public, and this is in Canada, you know, not exactly the most liberal country in the world in terms of rock stars. They didn't have any of them of their own in those days, you know. And I suddenly realised maybe this concert wasn't going to take place tonight. The show was late because they... And I said, what, they've fallen out over? And then somebody whispered in my ear, well...
Lover's tiff,
yeah, that's
darling.
Right, yeah.
Another
and
lover's
what?
Tiff.
And all that. But, I mean, that wasn't the start and end of the Boy George stuff, was it? Because I remember getting calls every day for weeks. Oh, this has happened, that's done. Ending up with Boy George... had a mate who died on the floor of his house, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And then he was arrested, wasn't he? Because he chained some poor guy to a radiator.
Yes, that's right.
Having had his wicked way with
him. That's right, started hitting him with a chain.
He went down for that one, as it were.
Yeah.
But, I mean, George will always be around as long as he lives.
Yeah.
Because he has
talent.
Well,
he's reformed himself.
But he's got an incredible voice.
Yeah.
And great soul and wonderful expression.
Yeah.
So he will always be an artist. He's not going to fade away.
Sure.
Like, say, somebody like Paul Young, whose voice deserted him at a certain point.
Did it?
God bless Paul. We love Paul. But, you know, he's not singing the way he once did.
Well, I don't think anybody does when they get to that age, do they?
I don't think I do, really, do you?
Well, I don't sing these days, so I give it a rest. How did you not get sucked into the rock and roll lifestyle? The drugs.
Never took drugs. I've never had a cigarette. I only have wet vices.
Yeah.
I developed my ability to drink on Fleet Street.
Yes.
You know what it was like.
Oh, of course I do.
Bottle of wine every morning, another bottle of wine at lunchtime, well, another one after hours, maybe two.
In that pub you just mentioned.
In the
what
Harrow.
Was it called?
The Harrow. And the wine press.
And the wine press. Well, in the Harrow in particular, because we had a... we had a crime editor called, what was his name? He'd been around for years. Well, we had a very, very old crime consultant called Percy somebody, who was about 87, and who had covered, like, you know, every crime from the Second World War to the Cray twins and everything else. I think he covered the Nuremberg trials, to be honest.
Wow.
And yeah. And then we had then his sort of, you know, the next guy came along. He was about 60. I can't remember his name now. You couldn't remember these guys' names because you never saw them.
Yeah.
But they used to go down to the Harrow every morning at 11 o'clock for what they call morning prayers. And there were two glasses on the bar set up by the barman. Pub didn't open until 12 in those days, but it did for crime correspondents in Fleet Street. One was a glass of sparkling water. The other one was the first glass of champagne of the day. And they would still be there at 8 o'clock at night. And there were no mobile phones in those days. And they just used to rotate and share the phone in the corner to file a copy from the pub. They never went anywhere.
That's how it was.
The cops used to come and see them.
Yeah.
The cops always knew when they needed a Fleet Street, you know, reporter to sell some line from Scotland Yard, they'd send a cop down and he'd sit there drinking with them. Amazing.
Wouldn't get away with it now, would you?
But no.
I mean, 11 o'clock was morning conference, wasn't it?
Yes, it was,
so
yeah.
Once the editorial staff all flooded into conference,
yes,
we nipped out for a drink.
Oh, absolutely.
And we were drinking in the morning.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
Of course,
it's absolutely terrible, isn't it?
Oh, crikey. I mean, never mind showbiz reporters and crime reporters. The news editor of the Express, when I first got there, because I was a quite junior reporter, I always thought it was very strange that this guy got in about 5 to 10. Conference was at 10 in the Express, right? It was over by 10:30 or 25 to 11. And then you didn't see him then until 5 to 1. And he came in just to check that his deputy was there to cover over lunch because he was going out for lunch, despite the fact he'd been in the Pop and Jay pub downstairs for the last 2 hours. And then he would come back at 3:45. Evening conference was 4 o'clock. That was over by 4:30. And he was back in the pub. That was the routine. Day in, day out. It's no wonder that some of the newspaper pension funds are the biggest in the world. Nobody ever lived to draw the money.
But this is another thing about why no drugs. You never saw people taking drugs on Fleet Street.
Mm.
And the reason is...
I didn't know drugs existed in those days.
They didn't need to, because they were sozzled out of their brains
the entire time.
I'm saying they, aren't I? I should really say we. But it was a gig every night, at least one gig, at least one party, at least one after-hours type thing.
Yep.
I can remember waking up in the Groucho Club, walking up to Topshop, buying a new shirt, getting a toothbrush on the way to work and going straight to the office, having been under a chair half the night in the Groucho Club.
I had a secretary on one of the papers where I was executive editor who knew to bring me a new white shirt in every morning. And there were 30 or 40 of them in the office because
Brilliant.
I never got home. You're absolutely right. Right, Leslie Ann, now thank you very much indeed for joining me. Just to remind people, they're listening to Life on Planet Porky, the new podcast. Zooming up the charts, by the way, and available at all good podcast locations, iTunes, Apple, Audio Boom, and Spotify. Thank you very much for coming in today. Tumbling Ice, I've got a copy in front of me. Fabulous book. I've both had a look at this and I've read some of the excerpts. Can I just go back? I know it's not going to sell copies of Tumbling Dice, which is the whole purpose of inviting you to my studio, but to your previous book, Bohemian Rhapsody, because eventually a film was made around Freddie Mercury's life, which you were highly critical of.
I was critical because the chronology was wrecked. So many things happened in the wrong order. Rami Malek as Freddie was all right. He put bums on seats. But he reminded me how dynamic, how special, how huge a character Freddie Mercury really was.
Mm.
And this guy couldn't hold a candle to him.
Mm.
And people said, oh, yeah, yeah.
But hang on.
But you're
talking about one of the most talented singer, songwriter, performers since the Second World War, and Freddie Mercury. And you're talking about an actor, a jobbing actor. How could you possibly say the jobbing actor could have any of the talents of Freddie Mercury? How could you expect him to emulate it?
Very big boots to fill. I think vocally they did a good job, because what they did, they mixed Freddie's true vocals with those of a guy called Marc Martel, another Canadian, who's a Freddie impersonator. So good that sometimes you can't even tell the difference.
Yeah.
And then they blended in some of Rami Malek's vocals as well.
Mm.
So what you got was a combination. So it sounded good.
Yeah.
The storyline Okay, they invented characters.
Yeah.
So the Ray Foster character, who's the guy who signs them at EMI,
yeah.
the one they fall out with, he didn't exist. That person never existed
right.
in real life. Why did they do that? Why did you have to make people up when there were so many real-life characters
okay.
they could have portrayed?
As I understand the Freddie Mercury story, Freddie Mercury actually lived life to more than the full, and because he had so many cultural relationships at a time when nobody actually knew... didn't even know that AIDS was a disease that was spreading around the world like wildfire. He was careless in the relationships he had. And sadly, very, very sadly, his huge talent was taken away from us when, you know, he barely sort of got going in the annals of rock history. It was very tragic, wasn't it?
It really was. But I can remember Paul Gammoccini down in Heaven. Do you remember that seedy gay nightclub under
Richard
Charing
Branson's?
Cross? Yes, in the old days.
Yeah.
And we'd all go down there on a Sunday night. It was the place to dance at the end of the weekend.
Okay.
And Gambo saying to Freddie, you know, in the light of what we know now,
yes.
i.e. the new disease that's wiping out the world.
Absolutely.
And was being blamed on gay people as a gay plague.
Yeah.
There was Debrett's wiping people out of Debrett's peerage if you had a gay member of your family, not if you were gay yourself.
Yeah, golly.
And so it was highly scandalous. Mm. And Paul said to Freddie, are you being careful in light of what we now know about this disease? And Freddie said, no, I'm just carrying on doing everything with everybody.
Yeah.
And by that, he didn't mean I'm a gay man.
Yeah.
He meant I'm doing everything with everybody.
Yeah, sure.
So I've always maintained Freddie wasn't gay.
Right.
Freddie was all things to all people, and that's why he's not with us today.
Well, he's bisexual, isn't he?
Yeah, you'd like to think that,
well,
but...
I mean, he was at least bisexual. I don't know.
I think the film did was suggest that he was a gay man who'd fallen in love with a woman.
Right.
And I think that did him a great disservice.
Okay.
Because he wasn't that reductible.
Okay. You were quite close to Brian May.
Yes.
And did Brian May spend 10 years getting this film... out
12 years, I think it was, in the end.
And yet you still think it didn't turn out right. Wouldn't Brian May have had an interest in the legacy of Freddie Mercury?
I think, Brian and Roger Taylor, the drummer, yes, of course they have.
Yeah.
But I think he explained it pretty well quite recently. He said, look, Freddie lived 45 years. Mm. A film is, max 2.5 hours long.
Sure.
How do you cram more than the highlights of somebody's great, fantastic life into that short a space?
Sure.
You've got to reduce things down. You've got to distill, crystallize, and really just give the bullet points, in a way, of the story. But you don't have to change things.
No. Well, certainly not with that. If you told the story of the Beatles, you wouldn't have to invent anybody to put it in, would you?
We all know the story anyway.
Well, exactly. But there's still bits of the story we probably don't know, to be honest. It's such a
There was one moment which really wound me up. I wrote about this everywhere. The band aren't happy with me, but I had to say it.
Yeah.
So they're rehearsing for Live Aid. Mm. And you've seen the film, you know, the moment where...
I haven't seen the film, no.
Okay, Freddie comes in. They're in rehearsal. He says to the rest of the band, I've got something to say.
Yeah.
I've got it.
Yeah.
Meaning AIDS.
Right.
And then they also have a meltdown. That didn't happen for 2.5 years after Live Aid.
Well, I can't imagine it could have happened at Live Aid because that was his best ever live performance.
Yeah,
everybody knows that.
It really was, wasn't it?
And, and surely, he mentally, he'd have been, you know, in some way affected by it. Anyway, listen, back to the book, OK? Tomlin Dice, Leslie Ann Jones. This is out now. It's roaring up the charts. Now, we've just been talking about a particularly... talked about film, the Freddie Mercury one. What about Elton John? Is Elton John in your book?
Yeah, he is. One of my jobs when I was on the Daily Mail was to go and terrorise Elton in Windsor.
In Windsor?
About once a week, yeah. So if it was a slow day for celebrity news, it would be LAJ, you know, get down to Windsor
and terrorise
the old poofter.
Yeah.
That was my gig.
Yeah.
And so I can remember the day they made up the story. Oh, we're slow. We haven't got a splash. Everybody over the wine press. What can we come up with?
Yeah.
I know, says someone, Elton John's having an affair with HRH Princess Margaret. And the story was written at the bar in the wine press.
You see, this is disgraceful journalistic behaviour of a type which I've been accused of during my life. But I wouldn't have done that. I couldn't care if the editor was standing there with a gun at my head. I could not have written that.
Seriously?
No. No.
So somebody got dispatched to ring Dickie Arbiter at the Palace. Do you remember he was the press spokesman at the Palace?
Yeah, I do.
LAJ has to go down to Windsor and terrorise the old poofter all over again.
Yeah.
It was sport, really, and I always felt Elton took it in good part.
Did Elton let you in?
Of course he let me in.
All the time?
Yeah.
But did you tell him what they were writing?
Of course.
Did he care?
No, he loved it because it kept his profile alive, yeah. And it also suggested that he wasn't gay.
In fact, funny enough, and the reason I'm mentioning Elton John is because there's a film out on Elton John now, obviously.
Saw it on Friday.
Oh, did you? What did you think?
Yeah, well... John Reed ain't going to be happy. He was Elton's manager for about 25 years.
Right.
God rest his mother, who was a lovely woman. Mm. She's completely trashed in it.
Yeah.
Dick James.
Are you talking about Elton John's mother?
Yes. Yeah, Sheila Fairbrother.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they didn't speak for many, many years.
Well, only because he got married to somebody she didn't like.
Right.
But I just...
You're talking about David Furnish now, his current husband.
It was awful. Yeah. I think Elton has used this film to settle old scores.
Right.
So Dick James is trashed. Ray Williams is trashed.
Yeah.
So Sheila Fairbrother...
Sorry, who's used the film to settle old scores?
Elton has.
Was Elton executive producer of this
film,
then?
Yes, he and his husband, David Furnish.
I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
I see. So it's all... Because somebody who saw it said to me there's an awful lot of gay relationships in it. You know, even though at one time when I was working with one of your friends in Fleet Street, he had a female wife who got close. Who he got close to. A colleague of ours, a joint colleague of ours, mutual colleague of ours, used to go down to Windsor and stay there.
They had separate bedrooms. Elton and Renata had separate bedrooms, which was a tragedy because she loved him.
Yes.
And he tried very, very hard to be straight, but he was never going to be.
Mm.
But the saddest story about Sheila Fairbrother, his mum, you know, they didn't speak for 4 or 5 years until her death, but at her 90th birthday... She hired an Elton John impersonator to perform at her party.
Yeah, yeah.
That made me cry.
Yeah, that was a bit sad, wasn't it? But I didn't realise it's like a propaganda tool for Elton John. He didn't mind the number of sort of gay affairs. I tell you something that I thought very, very poignant. On Good Morning Britain a few weeks ago, Piers Morgan, I don't know if you saw it, all of a sudden this woman comes up on the screen from somewhere in America. And she was Elton John's first girlfriend.
Oh, Linda, yeah.
He was going to marry.
Yes.
And they lived in digs, like next door to each other or something like that. And it was all going to happen. And then your song came out, right? Mm. That was his first hit, wasn't it? You know, written by him and Bernie Taupin.
It was his breakthrough hit, wasn't it?
Breakthrough hit. No, and all of a sudden, he just disappeared overnight. And they've never spoken to each other since. And that's going back like 50 years.
Yeah. He was trying really hard to be straight. You know, it happens.
Right.
A lot of gay men get married. What can I say?
Yeah, sure.
We are much more open and tolerant, and it's against the law to be otherwise in this day and age.
Yep.
So we take it for granted that people will express their true sexuality and identity in a way that they wish to nowadays. But back then it wasn't like that.
Well, talking about that and another huge star, is there anything about George Michael in your book?
Yeah, there's a little.
The reason I mentioned
visitation.
That is because just a week or so ago, the story was published about his will being released. £98 million, right? All to his two sisters, not a penny to his two former long-standing boyfriends.
Well, are we surprised?
Well, I don't know, you tell me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really, really close family again. I suspect that his mother always knew that he was gay. The father he was terrified of. The traditional Greek Cypriot patriarch.
Lives on a stud farm bought for him by George Michael many years ago.
Yeah.
Is that in Greece or somewhere?
No,
or?
I think it's here.
It's here, is it? Yeah.
I mean, those two sisters, Melanie and Yoda, they were devoted to him from when he was a tiny little boy. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Two big strapping sisters, and then along comes this little tiny cheeky chappy boy, and they idolized him. And so when he got famous, went out on the road, one was doing his hair and one was doing his PR and his makeup, and so he kept them very close.
Right.
I'm not at all surprised he left it all to them.
Do you remember the, obviously you will, but you remember it better than me, you know the video for Last Christmas, I Gave You My Heart, and they all go off skiing, have you seen that?
Yeah, it's a lovely film.
Yeah, but the first time I saw it, I thought...
He's gay.
No, I thought this guy's trying so hard to look like he's excited by all these beautiful women.
To be macho,
but, you know, you know, and smiling and grabbing them and hugging them. Mm. I thought there's something quite not right here. And that was in the days when you couldn't come out in public, could you, like you do now? The first time... what is the story of George Michael in your book?
Well, I've not really said it in so many words, but I'm pretty sure that George took his own life. Think about the date that it happened on.
Christmas Day.
You know, and also have had some dealings with his former psychiatrist.
Yeah.
The former psychiatrist's wife. George used to travel with a framed photo of his psychiatrist, which he'd have on the side of the bed. Now, who does that? Who has their psychiatrist on the side of the bed? That tells you a lot about his...
Yeah.
his mentality, doesn't it?
It's very sad if at the end of your life you've got 98 million quid, but you can't find peace in anything or joy in anything. You and I would say, well, that's it. Get off somewhere, half a dozen bottles of the most expensive champagne. That'll blast away the blues for today. We'll wake up tomorrow and think about doing something else, you know. But
George,
he must have been very tormented.
He went very low and very dark and got involved in some things which we wouldn't want to know about. People very close to him have said this as well. George became a person we didn't recognise. You got all that money, you have no peace, you have no relationship. You know, that wasn't an equal partnership, was it, the one he had with Faddy at the
end? I don't know. I've no idea how these things work, honestly.
Yeah,
I didn't know whether...
We know a bit about relationships, don't we, at this stage in the game?
Yeah, but when you're that rich and that powerful and that famous, right, I don't know how anybody else reacts to being alongside you. I don't know how David Furnish ever reacted to being alongside Elton John, because you're so much a minor part of a relationship,
aren't
you?
So are you falling in love with Reg Dwight, or are you falling in love with Elton John? That's the thing. Are you falling in love with the public persona?
Yeah.
And that's what I think torments them.
Yeah.
Does this person really want me for me? Or do they want that singer out there, the one with all the money and the limos and the private planes?
Sure. Yeah, that's the question. Right, so the book's out now. You can get it at all good bookstores, is that right?
Yeah, everywhere.
And I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to now just touch on... Oh, this is beautiful. You've brought me a copy. To dearest MP who knows where all the bodies are buried, from LAJ, who put them there. Love. Thank you very much indeed. That's great.
Pleasure.
And just before we finish, is it all right for me to ask you what your next great tome is going to be?
I'm working on a fine book, a retrospective of John Lennon, because next year, 2020, will be the 40th anniversary of his assassination. No, December the 8th, actually.
December the 8th.
Yeah. And what would have been his 80th birthday on the 9th of October?
Yes.
Incredibly, where did those years go? But it's very interesting. I was talking to my kids about why John Lennon.
Yeah.
So I said to them, you know, what you have to understand is that to my generation, John Lennon was our JFK.
Yes.
At which point my son said, what does an airport have to do with it?
Yeah,
you know,
right,
as far as they're concerned, JFK is an airport.
And well, so is John Lennon now.
But John Lennon also is an airport.
Yeah.
But they know everything about the music. They know the words. They know the melodies. You go to a McCartney concert, they're singing along all these songs.
Yeah.
How do they know these songs?
Yeah.
It's not like I play them at home all the time.
No.
So it's in their DNA, but they don't know who the man is. So I need to revive the man for the younger generation.
I've got a theory about the McCartney thing, because I was a huge Beatles fan and a little bit more John Lennon than Paul McCartney. They all loved Paul McCartney, but I saw Paul McCartney in Wings once and the crowd just wanted him to play Beatles songs. It was obvious, you know. And he spent a lot of years touring playing new Wings songs, which are pretty good, but they weren't Beatles classics. And then the last time I saw Paul McCartney was at the O2.
In December, just gone?
No, it was the one before that, about a couple of years ago. And he just played Beatles songs. And it was what everybody wanted.
And projects pictures
Absolutely.
Of John and George.
Absolutely.
And then he brought Ringo on stage.
Yeah.
Extra drum kit. On comes Ringo. And we're all in tears.
And then the Piper Band come on for Mull of Kintyre and all that. And that was the one sort of, you know, song which he attached to all the Beatles.
I said to the kids, photograph this with your eyes.
Yeah.
This cost me a grand to take all my family to see McCartney, but we never miss it. But I say, photograph this with your eyes. Because you will never... This is half the Beatles on stage.
Yes.
More than 50 years after they broke up.
Unbelievable.
You're never going to see this again.
Absolutely unbelievable. Right, OK. Well, Leslie-Ann, thank you very much indeed for joining us today in the Audio Boom studio here. Tumbling Dice, Leslie-Ann Jones, Sunday Times best-selling author of Bohemian Rhapsody. We wish you luck with this one and all future projects. And I want to say to everybody who's tuned in, thank you for listening. You're listening to Planet Porky, the podcast. Keep tuned, folks.
Well, I got the scoop and the splash and everything on that story, which was...
On which particular story?
Boy George's addiction to heroin.
Right.
So I'd spent the night in a boot of a car with George up on Hampstead Heath one night. God knows what we came up with that for.
What were you doing in the boot?
I think we thought this would be a good new interview venue, that we could interview each other in the boot of a car. So
no, you couldn't have been. You don't mean like the boot you lift up and then close and you were inside.
Well, we didn't close it. We left it open. But it was a sort of car boot interview type scenario.
Well, you were both sitting in the back of the car. In the grounds of his home.
In the dark with a bottle of wine. I'm pretty sure that George took his own life. think about the date that it happened on.
Christmas Day.
You know, and also have had some dealings with his former psychiatrist.
Yeah.
The former psychiatrist's wife. George used to travel with a framed photo of his psychiatrist, which he'd have on the side of the bed. Now, who does that? Who has their psychiatrist on the side of the bed? I developed my ability to drink on Fleet Street.
Yes.
You know what it was like.
Oh, of course I do.
Bottle of wine every morning, another bottle of wine at lunchtime, another one after hours, maybe two.
Now, first of all, let me just tell everybody the sort of background to the relationship you and I have had over maybe 30, 35 years.
Steady.
Yeah, well, you know, all very innocent and we all know that.